Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
And it's the 11th of March. Happy birthday to my sister, by the way. And on this day in 1958, a hydrogen bomb was dropped on Mars Bluff, South Carolina, by an Air Force B-47.
Oops.
About 4 in the afternoon, an MK-6 nuclear bomb, 100 times more powerful than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, accidentally slipped from its harness inside a B-47 bomber and plummeted 15,000 feet to Earth. The bomb, 10 feet 8 inches long and weighing 7,600 pounds, landed in a field in Mars Bluff, just outside of Florence, South Carolina. The Air Force said that it wasn't armed with a nuclear capsule, but it did contain a trigger of 1,000 pounds of high-energy explosives, which detonated on impact. The explosion left a crater 20 yards in diameter and 10 yards deep that's still there. At the time, Walter and Helen Gregg and their 3 kids lived about 100 yards from where the bomb exploded. It totaled the family's 1946 Chevy sedan and half-ton pickup truck. It also shook their house off its foundations and destroyed nearly everything inside. Miraculously, no one was killed. Air Force personnel recovered hundreds of pieces of bomb fragments that were carried off as souvenirs by local residents. The inhabitants of Mars Bluff, and you can't make that name up, think of that, Mars Bluff, I mean, war faint, you know. The inhabitants of Mars Bluff were examined for several months to see if they had been exposed to any radiation, which is very odd because the Air Force claimed that there was no nuclear trigger in the bomb, but still, no nuclear packet in the bomb. 5 months after the 5 months later, the Gregg family was awarded $54,000 from the Air Force, and the site of Walter Gregg's farmhouse is now a swamp. The incident at Mars Bluff was one of 32 admitted serious accidents, known as Broken Arrows. They made a movie out of that, I think, involving U.S. nuclear weapons between 1950 and 1980. We have no information for the last 25 years. In any case, that's today, 1958. That's worth thinking about our Inspiration Noam Chomsky gave a talk at Binghamton, New York last Saturday, in which he quoted agreement, apparently, the observation of a leading political scientist today that under current U.S. policies, a nuclear exchange is inevitable. Chomsky has characterized our present administration as perhaps the most dangerous in American history, and he means it quite literally in regard to nuclear weapons. Now, I mentioned this in connection with Chomsky only because Chomsky talking on the subject targeting Iran.
Wow.
And yes, and the question of
nuclear
weapons.
How recently was this recorded?
Last week in by David Barsamian in Massachusetts. And it raises these questions, unfortunately, in an all too immediate fashion.
It's an interview.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well,
recommended highly. I've had the pleasure, if that's the word.
We hope our listeners think it's fulfilling to hear some of this grim stuff, just because we're hearing so much obfuscation and untruth that even though it's bitter to hear some of the realities, I think it's important, and hopefully we'll maintain our spirits too. We have the death of is it Matt
Milosevic?
Michael Fox?
Thomas Fox. I think
Thomas
his name
Fox.
Is. Yes.
Yeah. I guess that was known yesterday. Apparently, Nightline had a piece on it, and some Christian peacemaker teams people were on that last night. I didn't know. I was making up for a week of being ill and not partying last night, and I'm kind of regretting it now, but it was worth it, I think, and even in retrospect.
Yes, this is tragic, of course. I mean, this group taken hostage in Iraq were people who were trying to do serious things to help the situation there, and this man Fox, the American, the other three are Brits, I guess, has been killed, and
one Canadian,
his body found last night.
Two Brits, yeah. The I was interested. I did wake up in time to hear most of NPR's weekend edition, mercifully with Susan Stanberg instead of Scott Simon.
Yes and no.
Well, in a way, it's just a relief to have a different thing happening than the usual.
It's just your deep involvement with Scott Simon, I guess.
I have a 5x7 yellow black and white glossy of Susan Stanberg from 1974 when I went to D.C. to give Nixon the bird, as it were, if I remember telling that story on the air. And couldn't meet any of the regular hosts. I actually thought I could just walk in and talk to some of the
I don't
the
think
hosts.
Scott Simon would turn your head with an 8x10 glossy, though, Paul. You'd still feel the same way about him.
Well, I think he looks charming, and occasionally he hits a funny bone with me, but it isn't often. So, but the bad that he's done is always a collegial kind of Chicagoan. Anyway, what was the point I was making was a differential coverage the two headlines. One of them had a brilliantly put together headline saying, acknowledging the condolences they've gotten from across the Muslim world, the CPT was saying this, and that it makes them even more steadfast, I don't know if they use the word, that's an important word in Arabic, to continue to bring attention to those thousands of people who are incarcerated in jails in Iraq and other places by the U.S. and coalition forces. And obviously that got chopped, and the second headline was more, these are the facts kind of thing. But I thought it was brilliant they got that through. I don't know what the Nightline reporting of it was. But they were drawing attention away, consciously drawing attention away of their own tragedy and pointing out that, incarceration, hostage taking is not exclusively on one side. I mean, it was even more explicitly done in the early days of the invasion that it was admitted that they were taking, American military was taking siblings, mothers, father, and brothers of people to put pressure on others, which if that isn't hostage taking, I don't know what the definition is.
The front page of the New York Times today on that point has an interesting juxtaposition of articles. The headline above the fold is "Symbol of Abu Ghraib Seeks to Spare Others His Nightmare," and there's a picture of the fellow who was in that hood and the electrical wires in the famous picture from
Abu
Ghraib. So-called
Vietnam posture, they call it.
His name, Ali Salal Kaisi, in Jordan, he's safely in Jordan now, shows holding the picture of himself on top of the box and the black hood and so forth, and an account of his experiences and the critique of the policies, imprisonment and torture policies of the United States. That, as I say, is above the fold. Below the fold, New York Times is nothing if not balanced, right? Below the fold, we have an article entitled "Muslims' Blunt Criticism of Islam Draws Threats and Some Hope." It's an article about a Syrian-American psychiatrist in Los Angeles who is attacking Islam. Now, you know, okay, fine. Interesting that the discussion should be juxtaposed that way, the two articles side by side. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that it's doubly interesting when American politics seem to be riled by, or perhaps roiled is the word that I want, by the propaganda of this administration turning around to bite it in the backside. This Dubai ports deal clearly is a result of the hate Islam campaign that the administration has recently cranked up to take the place of its other now abandoned accounts of its reason for killing several hundred thousand people in Iraq. You know, we got this strange backings and fillings this week on the Dubai ports world problem, which sees members of the Republican Party and the usual Democrat liberals attacking Bush using the propaganda the Bush administration has put forward. We can't have terrorists running our ports, not dealing with the real issue, that is the fact that the Bush administration has never tried to just do anything about terrorism by actually making investigation of things coming through our ports a serious concern. So it's replete with ironies,
and,
it seems
and
to me.
And one of the ironies yesterday was Bush defending the, saying, I'm still standing behind the deal and it's free enterprise and market economics, and this in defending a government, government-controlled corporation that's so in bed with the Cargill group, if not directly them, but the same type
Carlyle,
of money.
Carlyle's directly involved, I think.
Baker's behind it, supposedly as a rainmaker, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the high irony there. It's amazing. I predict that there'll be some propaganda from the Islamists, from the type of Bin Laden and such, the Salafi, Wahhabi, you know, condemning this is the fate of this decadent Arab kingdom. And, you know, I don't agree with the analysis, but frankly, they do have a point. This place is a real amazing. It's polyglot culture. There's 130 countries represented in Dubai. NPR had a feature this week talking about the various kind of pleasure palaces you could go to with Chinese whores on one side and Russian whores on the other. So I'm predicting
it's
that,
multiculturalism.
Yeah. Well, I'm predicting that there'll be some they'll claim victory for that too.
who coined the phrase "Dubai is the New York of the 21st century"?
I hadn't heard that.
It's being repeated now as a an account of what you know what's really going on there. What its significance really is.
New York is. You know, I guess it has a smuggling heritage too, didn't it?
Well, but I mean, being a sort of world city, and right. You know,
well, but I mean, Dubai,
as you say, culture and economics.
But Dubai is notorious for being. I heard one journalist say from Wall Street Journal saying that there wasn't a threat from some group in Dubai saying that they're only going to service a certain number of boats a month, and it seems to me that they probably don't really want to do that. But I think they're trying to put some countervailing pressure on someone to give them what they regard as a fair price.
Oh, I'm sure they'll get a fair price on it. I mean, what actually is going to happen? I mean, the announcement made, curiously, by Senator Warner that Dubai would transfer control of the American ports, maybe as many as two dozen American ports, to a U.S. entity. It's been suggested that the entity is Halliburton. It's also suggested that it will be a sort of spin-off of a subordinate corporation, but that the money will still be comfortably in the hands of people like the Carlyle Group, this investment combine that includes so many members of the Bush 1 and Bush 2 administrations. So the financial machinations are not at all clear, and I think what we've seen in the week that or 2 weeks that Bush has been threatening a veto of congressional action on the matter is just a lot of work backstage to make sure that the money is okay, to make sure that the people with the money are okay, and that a deal can be done here whereby the money will be in the pockets
make them
that
holes,
it's supposed to be.
Like
in.
Andy exactly. Fasto's agreement
exactly
with,
right.
with Ken Lay and group saying, well, you make that Shell Argent Corporation, and there's just no way you're going to lose money on it. We'll make you whole plus, I suppose.
Well, and
it's
I,
another
I,
cost plus contract.
Exactly.
I don't think it'll be Halliburton, though. I hear varying reports of two to four corporations that have the logistical whatever it takes to run these ports, which kind of, you know, strikes me as odd. And I think the longshoremen could probably start a cooperative and do it themselves, but that's the way I'm bent.
No comment.
Worker cooperative kind of things. I think the people on the ground actually do more, and I think the other people are raking off. But that's, you know, vulgar, isn't it? But Halliburton would be a delight for if it was turned over to Halliburton.
Well,
now.
That's what I thought. Yeah. You're listening to News from Neptune. Carlos Brook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and the coverage by the media. I thought it was a story on this issue, on the Dubai ports thing, that was heralded by a headline, an AP headline yesterday, and it was going to tell us that Halliburton was going to get the job. The headline was "Rat Squirrel Not Extinct After All." And it turned out to be some silly article about some animal found in Southeast Asia, you know. But it seemed to me, rat squirrel, that's about right. The article had to be about Cheney or about Halliburton or about how they're going to come out on top of this thing in some way. But it wasn't.
Well, Cheney and Bolton were foaming at the mouth this week, would you say, at APAC? It's quite a wonderful performance. You can't tell whether these people are saber rattling, playing chicken, or whether they really are, planning on going to war. I guess
this is
there's a faction. This guy I read on military issues, I don't share a lot, but he William Arkin wrote the book Code Names.
Right.
He's still saying that he's standing by his idea that there won't be a. An attack.
Yeah, well, I have to think. That seems to me to be...
But that's where
that could change. As you say, that's not a very... would be the probability, it seems to me, but hardly a certainty.
That's if logic prevails, though.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know, we have this situation of playing chicken, and, you know, these people are mad enough, it seems to me, deluded and self-deluding enough that, you know... Yeah, and I heard Tony Blankley say it's perfectly reasonable that, you know, a strategic strike on Iran could delay the program, you know, by some years. And, you know, on the other
editor at the Washington Times,
who was on the anti-Bush side of the Darfur agreement. I tuned in to see gas bag. I tuned into
which one?
The most self-promoting of those. To see how Limbaugh was handling it. He's going to the mat for Bush, saying, you know, this is crazy.
I've lost the thread here. What's Limbaugh saying?
He's defending the prez.
On what point?
On Dubai. He's saying that, you know.
So's Noam Chomsky, by the way.
Yeah, I know, that was interesting to hear him.
Defending the
sharing
president's
his analysis,
strong, but
saying he said he was a little uncomfortable with the idea of sharing the analysis.
The analysis that was being shared was that this is the global capitalist class doing its usual work on this matter. Nothing new about this. And the people like Hillary Clinton who are screaming about it are simply using a stick to beat the administration with that the administration has handed them. That stick being anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, hysteria.
Which you said something like ratcheted up, which is true because despite the fact that Bush meets with imams and breaks fast with them and stuff, there's been an undercurrent and an ongoing rhetorical stance, some of it from Cheney and the other supposed underlings, that's been been ongoing. It changes tactically, I guess, but now it's ratcheted up, and that's why I'm very disturbed about the possibility of things spinning out of control and an actual. Everybody's interpreting this remark in Vienna from the IEA representative from Iran about, the U.S. can cause pain and whatever the quote exact quote was, but they are not immune to it themselves. Mm-hmm. Let the ball roll thing as being about oil shock, but there's an interesting website, Iranian website, both in and out of the country, called you can just Google ROOZ, as I've heard it said, ROOZ online, and it has reporting from Iranian writers in English an interesting analysis about what's going on inside. There's a particularly one by a guy named Bustani who calls Ahmadinejad neocons. He calls them neocons in the context of. So when you
makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the sense that the neocon position in the United States has always been just at sort of one end of the policy spectrum. It's on the same spectrum that everybody else from Kennedy to Nixon to Clinton were on. The neocons just represent, one extreme of that. Now, that's not to minimize it. I mean, I quoted early Chomsky's notion that we're dealing with the most dangerous administration in American history. Now, to see Ahmadinejad in Iran on a similar position on a spectrum of Iranian policy seems to me to be not a bad way to put it. And in fact, as we know, within Iran, there is probably more opposition to the views and positions that he takes than there is to the equivalent views in this country. Right. The neocons are in better shape, probably in the Bush administration, than Ahmadinejad's views are in the Iranian administration. But the result, as you say, Paul, that still leaves us in a very dangerous situation indeed, because both sides are capable of miscalculation. Mm-hmm. And the miscalculation could be very serious indeed.
Well, it's sort of this possible inevitable. Well, that's a bit of contradictory, isn't it? The hardline stand of Bolton and Cheney's is just going to elicit support for Ahmadinejad. And
they love each other.
Yeah, they really do. And it's extremely disconcerting. Particularly, I can't understand what the EU is doing now, because they seem to, this Russian non-offer, non-brokered deal of letting the Iranians go ahead with some sort of limited research type of manipulation of, transuranics. I really suggest that we go solar. I mean, that's what we should have done in India too. We should have, if we want to do trade in that kind of thing and eliminate the competition of India for energy needs in the future, we should highlight the truly renewable resources. Bush was calling nuclear energy renewable. I guess he's implying the breeder reactor is the only way to go or something.
Well, 2 points here. Remember that 2 years ago, when the EU first started saying to Iran, look, we don't want you to go ahead and do this nuclear refinement for energy production that you're planning on and that you're perfectly entitled to do under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we don't want you to do it because the technology is such that that's too close to building a bomb. And Iran replied, I mean, these were in the negotiations in 2004, Iran replied, fine, we're willing to suspend that sort of stuff. But we need some things. We need the materials from elsewhere, and we need guarantees from the EU on security. Look at the map. We have American troops on both sides of us. We've got American allies with nuclear weapons on both sides of us, Israel in one case, Pakistan in another. We need a guarantee that you, the Europe, will defend us against the United States, or at least ensure that the United States will not attack us the way Israel attacked Iraq, the way the United States attacked Iraq. The EU said, yeah, fine, we can deal on that grounds, and the U.S. stepped in and said, no, you can't. The U.S. Scuppered the deal a deal that would have left Iran in the position of not enriching uranium as it's doing right now. And so their position ever since is, look, we had a deal. You all backed out. The Europeans backed down under American pressure. And therefore, we're going to do what we are entitled to do under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, that's a pretty... that position has never been expressed very clearly, I think, in the American media. But it's a pretty clear position, and it's a pretty defensible one.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the fact that the IAEA sent the complaint against Iran to the Security Council, but no recommendation?
I think it's important. I mean, it's what we have here is tremendous American pressure to get the International Atomic Energy Agency to refer Iran to the Security Council. They did it in part because they think, the IAEA did it in part because they think that sanctions against Iran can be blocked on the Security Council, that China will block sanctions against Iran. And the U.S. probably thinks that, too. And the connection here, Paul, I think, is in fact with the Indian trip. This peculiar deal that Bush did in India relates directly to Iran. Iran and India have had dealings all along, and particularly since the 1979 revolution in Iran. What the U.S. is most afraid of here is Iran, as it were, turning east. We have this growing energy community of China, Russia, and India is attracted to that, and the U.S. has got to make sure that India doesn't get into it. Now, the idea that India should be the link between the Russian-Chinese India energy grid and Iran, which is the source of a substantial amount of the world's energy resources, that was scaring them to death in Foggy Bottom in the State Department. And the reason Bush rushed to India and did a deal with India is to keep India out of this linkage. And then he goes to Pakistan, you know, our crucial ally, gives them the back of his hand because, in fact, we don't need Pakistan right now, and so except to keep the lid on. So the Indian trip, I think, has to be understood in terms of the U.S. position towards Iran. The real threat that Iran poses to the United States is switching its oil resources from control by American-based multinationals and having the oil go west to a situation in which the oil would go east to the Russian-Chinese energy grid. India is the link in that.
Yeah. Well, several days after Bush got back, he was asked about the deal that was going ahead with a gas pipeline from Iran to India, so it hasn't been entirely... successful.
Oh, yes. So. They can't stop it entirely, but they're desperate to control it, and that's the standard position. You're listening to News from Neptune. Carlos DeBrook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and its coverage by the media.
There's a fledgling Student for Democratic Society rebirth happening around the nation.
Students for a Democratic Society was the major student anti-war organization from during the 1960s. Founded in 1962 out of a former basically labor youth group, and breaking apart in the summer of 1969 at a convention in which its various political tendencies ended up at war with one another. It was always a peculiar organization, Paul. Yeah. I mean, it began with democratic and anarchist principles that the original model of Students for a Democratic Society was let the people decide. As SDS grew, groups within SDS decided they wanted to do deciding a good deal more than they wanted to let the people do it. And so there were various and sundry political groups with roots in the old left and in indeed the so-called new left in this country, had a lot to do with the organization. So there aren't too many parallels between Vietnam and Iraq. The only real parallel is the continuity of American policy. But if somehow challenging the United States of amnesia, as Gore Vidal calls it, and actually remembering what went on in the anti-war movement and remembering it accurately in regard to Vietnam is helpful to the contemporary anti-war movement, all well and good. I have my doubts.
Common Dreams has a piece by William Odom talking about Vietnam and Iraq. I didn't take time to read it because he's against the war, but for his own reasons, and he's a former head of a national security agency, so, or not, if not head, he was higher up in it, and it seems to me that anybody that can author a book called Accidental Empire about the U.S. has to be a little bit questioned about his thoroughness of his analysis.
Empire doesn't look that accidental to you.
No, indeed. If you look at Kennan's famous quote about what we have to do with make sure we keep control of the Mideast oil, I mean, everything post-war is up till today and to our contemporary times and to this very moment seems to be about that.
Much more conscious than that, I quite agree. Tom Hayden, who 43 years ago wrote the Port Huron Statement, the founding, 44 years ago now, God help us, the founding statement of Students for a Democratic Society, has in the intervening years taken some peculiar political positions and wandered on in various ways, was a long time state legislator in California. But he has a piece on that same Common Dreams website this week that actually is quite good. It's a talk about, for a while there he was saying, well, you know, we've got to get out of Iraq, but we can't do it precipitately, the sort of Democratic Party position, you know. He was seriously criticized for that, as he should have been, and he's thought about it and come forth now with a much better discussion, it seems to me, of the U.S. and Iraq and what it means for U.S. politics in general. And I recommend, I think the article was published originally on the Common Dreams website, but Tom Hayden, H-A-Y-D-E-N, it's worth looking at to promote a real discussion about what the U.S. is doing and what has to be done to stop it, so to speak.
And last time I checked, he had a regular show on Air America. I don't know if he's still out there with his rather raspy voice, but he's still slugging.
A lot of meetings over 44 years.
Yeah, a lot of hollering, I guess.
Shadid on the... What did you make of his presentation?
I thought it was good.
This is Washington Post reporter who has written about written a good deal for a long time about Iraq.
He definitely speaks Arabic, reads it quite fluently. He's very in touch with the people of Iraq, and you can tell he's pained by the the devastation visited, and but he doesn't have any solutions, and he does sort of use the, well, I'm a reporter kind of line.
That's disturbing, isn't it? I mean, when... Well, the solution, at least the short-term solution for Iraq, couldn't be clearer. I mean, as people like Cindy Sheehan and so forth continue to point out, why it's clear what has to be done. The question is, how can we prevail upon our leaders to do it?
Indeed. I don't know. An interim force of Muslim Arab League, I don't know. It just seems like there is going to be a vacuum. And Amy Goodman was in Britain all week, and she had a woman who was incarcerated by the Saddam regime who's been campaigning against the occupation and doing great work, talking about how she was exposing, you know, Abu Ghraib months before, which the Christian Peacemaker team, of course, were doing as well. But I guess it takes pictures to make it into the public discourse in this society, this current world, current media-driven world, as it were. But she was saying, we've always said there was no sectarian dispute. I didn't even know what religion my best friends were.
It's interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah. And we've always discounted, and I've talked to Iraqis who say, you know, civil war isn't in the cards. Cute observer Robert Fisk also discounted it, but she said she's come around to the idea that things have gotten so grim that civil war is probably already here. So.
Well, I think the problem is here, and the thing that people are saying from all points of the political spectrum, look, civil war serves only one party's interests. Mm-hmm. A unified Iraq with a government that could say, as all the Shiite parties said before the election, they want the U.S. to go. A unified government that said that to the United States would be the worst thing that could happen from the United States' point of view, because the U.S. is determined on controlling the energy resources with permanent bases in Iraq. So the one thing the U.S. has got to stop is a unified Iraqi government that says that to the United States. Okay, how do you stop it? Well, one way you stop it is by the Salvador option, the black ops, the special operations that this Pentagon has particularly been calling for all along. The sorts of activities that the U.S.
implementing
government,
much less calling.
Exactly. Yeah. The sorts of activities that the Pentagon has implemented literally around the world. Now, in that situation, it's very difficult not to presume that the encouragement of civil war, getting these groups to fight with one another, is coming straight out of the Pentagon and the assets that the Pentagon has acquired for itself in Iraq all along. I mean, remember, even things like the COINTELPRO project in the United States was based on an attempt, its fundamental strategy was an attempt to set black civil rights groups against one another, to get them to fight with one another, to kill one another. Now, that was what they were willing to do domestically to stop dissident groups from impacting American politics. What the U.S. has been willing to do abroad, look at Latin America, look at what the U.S. has done around the world in this in similar ways. It's hard not to see the Civil War being promoted actively, that is, both members of both sides being murdered and perhaps the Samarra Mosque being blown up by American instrumentalities in Iraq.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking we'll never know about that, but we don't have
Why
to.
Why not?
You don't even have to make the maximalist point that everything the U.S. has done, from hiring this group in somewhere in North Carolina to help set up the post-war government that just completely started defining everything in sectarian lines. You know,
exactly. Yeah. Right. And by the way, there's a good article on the Counterpunch website this week called something like Four Suspects in Search of a Prosecutor.
I would have added a couple more, John.
Well,
Yu would
but
be
what it talks about there is the folks in the primarily in the Pentagon who are responsible for this sort of operation. Now, it does it, I mean, relatively gently. It simply talks about the things they've said to make clear what their policy has been. These are people at the sort of second level under Rumsfeld, but the civilians who really are running the Pentagon and are indeed running this war, in spite of the State Department and in spite of the White House. Now, given that situation, given that these people are there and that those are their policies, I don't think it's as much of a leap to see civil war as being encouraged. I mean, it works in two ways for the United States. If a civil war situation has been promoted by neocons people like Daniel Pipes all along. Bernard Lewis even years ago said, well, the best thing we could have is a breakup into warring groups, a Lebanization, when Lebanon was in civil war itself, of the Arab world. That serves American and, of course, Israeli interests. The civil war, specifically in Iraq, could be an excuse for the U.S. to withdraw, to hold on to the strong points, of course, that it insists on holding regardless, but saying, look, these people, this is what Rumsfeld's been saying this week, these people got to solve these problems themselves. If they can't do it, we're just going to get out.
I don't think he went that far.
No, he's not. But I mean, I'm saying that there are two lines of argument, contradictory but mutually helpful to the American position. One is civil war makes it impossible for us to bring peace to Iraq. Therefore, we're not even going to try. The second word is civil war in Iraq means that America has to stay because it's obvious now it would be chaos if we left. So they can argue it either way. As I say, the one thing that doesn't serve American interests is a unified Iraqi government that says it's time for you all to go. They're not going to. That's the one thing they're going to avoid.
Right. Well, they're having trouble timing it. They want the drawdown to be right just before the U.S. elections, and they want they're going to have to put the lid on it in just the right fashion and bring it to a simmer at just the right time, as it were. And I don't know whether there anyone is capable of anything like that right at this point. I think there's one thing to say that it's still been a limited success for the rulers. You know, they can, you know, as long as they can weather this, which, you know, maybe that is looking little, you know, electorally looking more possible now than ever. I'm still not confident that, you know, the U.S. is fully in the Middle East and with the bases, and that's the, as you said earlier,
right,
that is the main goal.
And we're not leaving. That's true. That's exactly right. That's one of the major differences, we've mentioned this before, between Vietnam and Iraq. Both are demonstration wars. People are being told this is what the U.S. will do. But in Vietnam, the U.S. could withdraw without any withdraw its troops without any problem. It destroyed Vietnam anyhow. Look what Vietnam is doing today. They're begging for Nike factories. It could do that. But that can't happen in Iraq, because the U.S. is not going to abandon its control over Iraqi oil, and that just won't happen.
In the bigger geostrategic of the Middle East, Britain's Newsnight Thursday did a 11.5-minute expose, Britain's nuclear link with Israel revealed. We talked in August about the fact that this heavy water deal with the Norwegians in one room, the Israelis in another room, and the Brits in another room, with intermediaries going in, well, we'll ship you back heavy water that you sent us, but then the Norwegians just passed it on to, all supposedly done without the knowledge of the technology minister, who was Tony Benn, who, this is all breaking while Amy's in the UK. You wonder whether she might have known it. I don't really know.
I don't either.
She picked a particular time.
Tony Benn is the man who should have been British Prime Minister, probably, if Labour had, you know, ever been Labour. But in any case, this is particularly, I mean, it says a lot about sort of the secret government, the continuing government in Britain, and there's no reason to believe that we're not dealing with, of course, a similar situation here in the U.S.
I don't know. He's convinced that the Prime Minister at the time didn't know.
But that's even more shocking, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Well, but the second expose, again, it's only 11.5 minutes long, BBC Newsnight. You can look for it. I had a little trouble viewing it. I kept reloading the page, and eventually it played. But it talks about further dealings after the heavy water. Small, seemingly insignificant amounts of plutonium and lithium-6 and things like that. But I gather in the research field, it's important to have a sample of something if you're going to make it. And of course, the French did more. Or sub rosa, I guess, undercover to facilitate the Dimona plant. In fact, one of the things that one of these people on the BBC interview, I forget what his portfolio at the time was, he said that, you know, once he saw pictures of Dimona, that Mordecai Vanunu revealed that one of the buildings was almost, you know, a dead ringer for a French nuclear plant that
Israel was saying it's a textile factory or something like that, right? You know, and here it was. Yeah, it was a copy of the French nuclear installation.
Where their peaceful area was there was a fake wall. We talked about that at some length. And
the
U.S. Maybe wittingly, maybe unwittingly accepted the idea that there wasn't anything going on nefariously. Again, I return to the point that the IEA did include in some of the earlier deliberations about, I guess when they accepted the study of the Iranian situation, that they renewed the idea that there should be complete denuclearization of the whole region.
Well, that would be very interesting if that gets discussed at the Security Council, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think somebody might bring it up, because
I
don't think it was Little Egypt that actually got it included. Mm-hmm. So it's... I don't think Bolton has the subtlety to finesse this. It's not one of his strong suits.
We'll see if the Chinese mention it. I mean, it would be they would be the logical people. Mm. They're the folks the U.S.
Well, I think the Russians wouldn't be liable to
bring
it up.
That's possible too. That certainly is a possibility. Should we talk about the death of Milosevic in our last several minutes here?
I was going to go to that globalresearch.ca site, the Serbian and Canadian guy, and to see whether he had a link to this report on the trial that we were touting contemporaneously in the first year of the trial. The Dutch jurist was an observer, and he released a scathing report on the trial. I mean, Milosevic was saying he was in a kangaroo court, and you know, one doesn't have to like him or agree with him on a lot of things to say that, you know, according to this,
there are a lot of marsupials around. Yeah,
Dutch jurist. He was right. This was justice of the victors, as
yep.
it were.
Absolutely, that's yeah. quite right. Do you think he died a natural death?
He wasn't well, so mm-hmm. it's possible. I don't know if it, you know, the you're going to suggest that Clinton had something to do with it, so he wouldn't have to testify.
Certainly, you know, you look at it. One of the things he was doing was saying one of the things that was going to happen when the trial resumed on the 14th was that Milosevic was going to say, "I have to have Clinton as a witness." You know, I mean,
not other major actors too.
Maybe a little Vincent Foster strikes again, huh?
I'm a little disappointed that, but I don't. I think the news coverage would have been so one-sided that it wouldn't have. Made any real impact anyway.
But, well, you're right. It was amazing. And you started today by saying some nice things about Susan Stamberg and the NPR this morning. Did you hear her account of the death of Milosevic? It was headlined, I quote, "The death, you know, coming up next, the death of a war criminal." And then she went on to quite a long summary of the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, and it could have been written by the Clinton State Department. I mean, it was a complete account of how Milosevic set off on a genocidal campaign that was stopped only by when the U.S. bravely got NATO to intervene and bomb the country for 80 days. I mean, it was pure propaganda. I mean, none of the ambiguities that you mentioned were even alluded to. This was the NPR account this morning. I mean, an official radio, an official version of the events in Yugoslavia and Serbia and the Clinton attack on that country.
Maybe
astonishing.
Sylvia Pajoli's got a contract with VOA, too. We've been talking about how NPR reporters...
In fact, I was blaming Stanberg. You're right. It was Pajoli who gave this account.
Well, the headline also, I don't know, I can't remember exactly if it said war criminal in it, but it also accused him of engineering the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Exactly.
Which is a little turning things on its head, it right. seems to me. Uh-huh. I mean, he wanted to be head of a full, total right. Yugoslavia,
exactly.
and it was the U.S., EU, Germans' early recognition of
Precisely.
Croatia that... And, you know, we talked about the attack again by my favorite nefarious agents, bureaucrats in the world, the IMF and the World Bank.
Yep.
There was a concerted, I think, destabilization of
absolutely right
of South Slavia in progress, and that's what exacerbated the long-standing tensions. One
Very can't, true.
One doesn't deny the tensions that are on the ground.
And none of this, of course, was in the NPR account. Mm. There's also, I mean, at the level, you know, at the micro level here, of course, wasn't micro to him, I guess, there was the suicide of Milan Milan Babic, who was testifying he committed suicide, that's the official story at least, he committed suicide in the same prison where Milosevic died last night, a week ago. Now, this is a guy, a Serb, who was apparently running Serbian military activities in Croatia for the Milosevic government. And he was testifying against Milosevic by saying, yes, indeed, what we were doing was all done at the behest of the president of Serbia, Milosevic. He turns up dead. It was said by his own hand in the Hague prison last week, and a week later, Milosevic, heart gives out. Now, once again, I mean, you don't have to. There are various possibilities here. As you say, Milosevic was not a well man. In fact, he was asking to be released to go to Moscow to have his heart trouble treated.
Right.
You know, and the court was denying it. For the first response from Milosevic camp when he turned up dead was that the court had encompassed his death by not getting him the medical treatment that he needed. Still in all, the situation is, at the very least, embarrassing. opening for this UN constructed court for the former Yugoslavia. And the situation, when the news reports ignore all these things that we've been mentioning and do not talk about the politics at all, we have an act of, you know, a massive act of propaganda, of obfuscation, in which the U.S. government and the media are certainly embedded in one sense.
Well, again, I don't want to, I will never know, but it wouldn't have been that hard to change his heart medicine a little bit, I suppose, to have something happen. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it happens right at the time when Akim Ketu was elected to be head of Kosovo, and he's making all sorts of conciliatory remarks, but it reminded me, and some of the coverage I heard on the BBC, is that the last prime minister elected at Kosovo had to resign to face trial as a war criminal, Albanian Kosovar. From my understanding, and Chomsky in his book on that we've cited a number of times over the couple of weeks, Military Humanism or Humanitarianism, Lessons from Kosovo, talks about Akim Ketu at some length, and good prima facie case for at least an indictment. So, and I'd heard that, I think I talked to some scholar on it and said that he had heard that there was a sealed indictment on Ketu, and that it was just a matter of time before it would proceed. UN official says he doesn't have any problem with Ketu being elected to the position, so I don't know, maybe he was appointed by Bolton or something. About 6 minutes left, and still so much.
Indeed. I've got, I'd like to know what you think of this in terms of the general politics and how it will play out in the coming elections. I got a letter from a friend of mine this week, fellow I've known for years, who lives in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire politics are very interesting. I mean, their first-in-the-nation presidential primary means that you've got a small and active political class in New Hampshire. There's so few voters that the people who want to run for president visit most of them before the primary.
Whitest, richest state in the union, actually, I think Connecticut and Hampshire.
Toggle
for the richest.
But it's it has some interesting characteristics. And here's a friend of mine who is in fact a retired salesman, basically. Smart guy who pays attention to what's going on, but not particularly. He's certainly not professionally involved in politics in any way at all. He recently wrote a cookbook, for example. But he sent me a letter, and he says the following. I quote: "The national scene is a disgrace, but as one of my neighbors observed, it's over. The neocons have gotten everything they set out to get. More power in the executive office, now four Scalias on the high court. Norquist has his tax cuts on programs that affect the least able, has his cuts, spending cuts on programs that affect the least able of the country. Tax cuts that benefit the top 0.1% of our population. Tax breaks for big business, particularly in the energy sector. Dismantling of environmental safeguards. A military beachhead in the Middle East. And it just goes on and on. Money and power are too great to overcome. My hoped-for scenario," he writes, "is that the country will elect a Republican, as opposed to another neocon, as president, and a Democratic Senate in 2008. The Republican will read the balance sheet and react much the way W's father did and realize he has to raise taxes to bail out the country. And it should be up to the Republican Party to extricate us from Iraq." Close quote.
Did he add anything about a gerrymandered congressional district system?
That's nothing new. It's always been that way. So it's. But my point is that here is someone who's. I mean, the two points in the letter, it seemed to me, that are worth talking about, and I'm taking this as in some sense typical of what some thoughtful people around the country who will be voting are saying. First of all, basically, the neocons are in command, and he's using neocon broadly there to mean the Bush administration, and that the opposition to them is finally not serious. And his second thing is, and therefore, the only thing to do is, of course, to vote Republican in 2008 and hope that it's not a representative of the same branch of the Republican Party, and that they're checked by a Democratic Senate. Now, this counts as political wisdom, you see, and I think a lot of thoughtful people are going to be thinking that way.
How do you arrange to have that wing of the Republican Party to become ascendant, though?
Well, they think that
certainly
it's got a
lot
name.
Of people think
it's
McCain.
Got a name, sure.
Some
the
people
name
say
is
that,
McCain.
And some people say that McCain is, but he's as bloody about Iraq as anyone.
Of course he is. That's the problem. And McCain, you know, is positioning himself very much to take advantage of my friend's vote. And I would not be at all surprised that he votes for McCain, you know, in the New Hampshire primary. I'll get back to you on that by the time the New Hampshire primary rolls around.
That would probably include an attack on Iran if it does get stalled for into the next 2 or 3 years.
McCain and his good friend Barack Obama, they laugh at Washington soirees these days at each other as pen. They address each other at Washington soirees as pen pal. Are at one on this point that. And as the administration says, Iran will not be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon of any sort. That's McCain, that's the, quote, left wing of the Democratic Party, and that's the Bush administration. There's no difference amongst them on this.
Well, when you don't expect it, something unexpected happens. There you go. The Bush administration stood up for press freedom this week. Do you know this story? It's a little bitty story, but... worthy of note.
You're grasping at straws, Paul.
Well, it's kind of ironic what part of the you know the environment, the polity it occurs in. This guy Kramer, who has a very popular show called Mad Money on CNBC, I guess. I only saw him once.
Right.
And he was singing the praises of Freeport Mac Moran, one of the bloodiest corporations in the world, and
exactly.
Talking particularly about how this is the word you need to know, state capture. They are the biggest taxpayer to the government of Indonesia. It's a country where rule by the corporations, for the corporations, you know, of the corporation is, and that's why it's such a good investment. Okay, this is the guy. But apparently he and another journalist were subpoenaed about some kind of stock manipulation of overstock.com, short selling, I guess it was. And Christopher Cox, the business-friendly guy that got put into the SEC and gave up his position in Congress, overturned it. What's this? What's going on here? Freedom of the press. You know, you can't mess with this. But it's the business press, of course, that gets a special treatment, right?
Yeah. I mean, Bush advisors are leaving because they're being arrested for shoplifting. I mean, that's the. this is what's really happening to these guys, I guess.
Well, it was a little more sophisticated than shoplifting. It was refunds. Well,
several thousand dollar shoplifting.
Yeah. So you'd expect them to be shoplifting
on a
mass
that's
scale.
Exactly. That's what they do. Sure. This is just concretizing a metaphor.
Gail Norton got a better offer in industry, I think.
Actually, that's an even more interesting story. This
she
is
came
the
out
interior
of National
Secretary.
Lead. She was the apologist for the lead industry.
But more importantly, she is probably the first casualty of the Ebrimov scandal in the Bush administration. I mean, this is the Interior Secretary who resigned suddenly at the end of this last week. The suggestion is that this is the tight nexus with the Abrahamoff scandals in the Bush administration.
I think you subscribe to Vanity Fair, right? So did you read the close and personal thing?
I actually haven't read the article. I mean, you know, I'm not particularly interested in hearing Abrahamoff's self-justifications, but yeah, it probably is worth looking at.
Yeah, I think it's a curious study, and he talks about being betrayed and all this and how many photographs he has, but he won't release the photos of... that he has with Bush.
Maybe he'd be careful to check his heart medicine too. You know,
I still wonder how much. I still wonder how much he charged. He got for escorting people in to meet Bush, because that's what he was doing.
You've been listening to News from Neptune, Carlos Brook and Paul Muth, and De Valente. We will be back around to do this again sometime.